Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is one of America's preeminent scholars on the history of the Civil War era. Eric Foner is a professor emeritus of history at Columbia University and an acclaimed historian of numerous books, including The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln, and American Slavery, which was awarded the 2011 Pulitzer Prize in History along with the Bancroft Prize and the Lincoln Prize. His latest book examines the tumultuous period following the Civil War, when Americans grappled with the role of newly freed African Americans and what a post-Civil War South should look like. Foner refers to the period as the Second Founding, a time of fundamental change in the notion of American citizenship and citizen rights, a time where our ideals first directly confronted race, even if it was largely written rights rather than rights in full. This period spawned three constitutional amendments, the 13th, outlawing slavery, the 15th, enshrining the right to vote for black Americans, and the 14th, guaranteeing due process and the basic rights of citizens, an amendment so sweeping that its impact is still litigated today. Foner's book is titled The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. That's also the focus of his lecture when he gives the Hager Distinguished Lecture in Law Thursday evening, October 17th at the University of Tulsa Law School. He joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Eric Foner, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Very happy to be here.
Your new book is titled The Second Founding. So very quickly, what is the Second Founding?
Well, the first founding, of course, was the writing of the U.S. Constitution in 1787, after the achievement of independence. The Second Founding is the way the Constitution was rewritten in the aftermath of the Civil War and the abolition of slavery. The book is about the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that were added to the Constitution right after the Civil War, which really, the point of the title is that these were not simply changes to an existing structure, but they really created a new Constitution. They made the Constitution for the first time, first of all, an anti-slavery document abolishing the institution of slavery throughout the country. The original Constitution, in some ways, had protected slavery. The Second Founding introduced the concept of birthright citizenship, that is, that anybody born in the United States, with a few exceptions, were automatically citizens. That had not been the case before the Civil War, because free African Americans were not necessarily citizens. The Supreme Court said that in the Dred Scott decision, that only white people could be citizens of the United States. And amendments also put the principle of equality among these citizens into the Constitution for the first time, really making the Constitution a document to which Americans of all races or backgrounds could appeal if they felt they were being denied basic equality. And finally, the 15th Amendment, giving African-American men the right to vote throughout the nation. And this, again, was a tremendous change. Before the Civil War, black men could only vote in a handful of states in New England, where there were hardly any of them. The phrase before the Civil War, which was unfortunately basically correct, that was widely used, this is a white man's government. That was changed. One newspaper editor in the 1860s said, these amendments changed the Constitution from a document for white men to one for all of mankind. So in a way, the Constitution we live under today really originates with the Second Founding and these fundamental changes to the existing Constitution.
We generally think of the 14th Amendment, and certainly it shows up every single Supreme Court term, as being the amendment that redefined federalism. But you're right, actually it was the 13th, which abolished slavery, did that. Why is that?
Well, the 13th, the right of a state, of any state, to have slavery was embedded in the original Constitution. Slavery was created by state law. It could be abolished, and of course, northern states abolished slavery in the aftermath of the American Revolution. But there was no federal power before the Civil War to interfere with slavery in the states. In fact, the national government occasionally had to protect slavery, such as tracking down fugitive slaves, things like that. So really, the 13th Amendment changed the balance of power between the federal government and the states. Now the federal government is telling the states there is one thing they cannot do. They cannot recognize anymore the condition of slavery anywhere in the United States. So that was the beginning of a dramatic shift in the federal system, which, as you suggest, continued with the 14th and 15th Amendments. You know, one way to think about this is each of those amendments ends with a section saying Congress shall have the power to enforce this amendment. Really, you know, a shift in power within the federal system from the states, which it had tremendous leeway before the Civil War, to a different system with the federal government now overseeing the states and intervening, if necessary, to make sure that the states abided by the new principle of equality for all Americans.
When it comes to amendments to the Constitution, that's the first time that phrase appears, where it actually enhances federal power at the expense of the states.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, they were restrictions on the federal government. The very first words of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law, you know, violating the freedom of speech, freedom of the press, etc. Their restriction on the federal government, and indeed before the Civil War, the states could violate the Bill of Rights. It was almost universally believed that the Bill of Rights only applied to the federal government. Now, from Congress shall make no law to Congress shall have the power. Now, as I said, the Bill of Rights is supposed to apply to the states as well as the federal government, and Congress has the power to implement that if the states do not live up to those principles.
Now, I was struck in the opening section of your book where you write about the idea of citizenship at this particular period. We'd already lived through our first anti-immigration period in America, but what you write is the idea of citizenship and an understanding of the rights that were tied to it really didn't develop in this country until Reconstruction, and it had a lot to do with race. Why did it take so long for this concept to develop?
Well, yes. The fact is that the original Constitution mentioned citizens a good number of times, but nowhere does it declare who actually is a citizen of the United States. It does say that the president must be a natural-born citizen, which seems to suggest that being born in the country makes you a citizen of the country. However, that doesn't apply to black people. There's a racial barrier within the idea of citizenship before the Civil War. Many states refused to recognize free black people as citizens. As I said, the Dred Scott decision of 1857, the Supreme Court said no, citizenship is only for whites. The first Naturalization Act, 1790, dealing with immigrants from abroad, basically said white people can become naturalized citizens, but most others, and Africans, Asians, etc., cannot. So the question was, did citizenship come from birth or from race or both at the same time? Also, what did you get as a citizen? Now, before the Civil War, there was no definition of what the rights of citizens were. It was almost like a little Phi Beta Kappa key you got. You know, you could wear it, but it didn't actually carry any particular benefits with it. Now, again, in Reconstruction, the 14th Amendment creates this principle of birthright citizenship regardless of race. Anybody born in the country, and of course, this is still a controversial point even today, 150-odd years later. As you know, the president has on a number of occasions declared that he could, by executive order, deny citizenship to children born in the United States to undocumented immigrant women. That would be to my mind, a pretty clear violation of the 14th Amendment, and the president, generally speaking, doesn't have the right to abrogate constitutional amendments. But, yeah, the notion of citizenship is defined clearly for the first time, and the rights that come with citizenship in these three amendments to the Constitution, which is another reason why they're so important.
Also, up to this date, and really even past this date, citizenship did not presume equality, did it?
No, it certainly didn't. For example, women, white women anyway, born in the country, were assumed to be citizens, but they lacked many of the rights that men had. They couldn't vote anywhere before the Civil War in the United States. The common law elevated the husband over the wife in innumerable ways. So, yes, citizenship did not mean equality. Again, it's the 14th Amendment, which first of all says anyone born in the United States is a citizen. Then it says that no state can deny the privileges and immunities of citizens, although it doesn't say exactly what those are. And actually, the notion of equal protection of the law in the 14th Amendment applies to all persons. It goes beyond citizens. No person can be denied the equal protection of the law, which includes aliens, people who are not citizens, But, you know, Reconstruction was a period of tremendous debate about this notion of equality, and with the abolition of slavery kind of catalyzed a whole debate about equality, what it meant, who should be entitled to it, and really how to make this a country that for the first time lived up to the principle. After all, the Declaration of Independence, it said all men are created equal, but certainly the country before the Civil War was far from living up to that ideal.
You write that the times of the 13th through the 15th Amendments was a time of rapidly changing attitudes. As the impact of these amendments overtook public opinion or issues surrounding race, how did these amendments, as they were adopted, affect public opinion? You write about it really changing public opinion quickly.
Well, public opinion was really in flux. For example, when the Civil War ended, very few of the dominant Republican Party of the North were in favor of giving the vote to black men right then. They felt they weren't ready, or they didn't even know what would happen if they thought maybe the old planters would tell them how to vote and they'd go and do that. They try to protect their basic civil rights, but 5 years later, black male suffrage is put into the Constitution. In other words, there had been a rapid change in public sentiment about whether African-American men should become part of American democracy or not. Then, of course, there were groups like the women's movement, who said, well, wait a minute, these amendments also empower us. One of the things about the 14th Amendment, particularly, is that these principles don't have a gender basis. When they talk about equal protection, it applies to everybody. It doesn't say anything about gender, and it doesn't say anything about race. It's obviously inspired by the need to protect the former slaves, but it applies to everyone. And so very quickly, all sorts of groups begin trying to use the 14th Amendment to promote their own interests and equality, and in a way stretching it or trying to stretch it beyond what the people who actually wrote it were intending. You know, so there's a big debate today among jurists and others. Do you go with the intention of the authors, or do you go with the actual language? And the actual language says nothing about gender, nothing about race. And that's why in our own time, in the last couple of generations, the 14th Amendment has been used to expand the rights of all sorts of Americans. I mean, very recently, of course, the gay marriage decision is a 14th Amendment Supreme Court decision. Equal protection of the law. If heterosexual people can marry, gay people cannot be denied the right to marry. That wasn't on the minds of the people who wrote the 14th Amendment in 1866. Obviously, that wasn't a political issue then. But it fits with the language of equal protection. They were trying to put down general principles which could be applied in all sorts of ways that might not be anticipated as time went on.
My guest today is Eric Foner, a professor emeritus of history at Columbia University and a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. His latest book is titled The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. It's published by Norton. He'll be presenting the Hager Distinguished Lecture in Law Thursday, October 17th at the University of Tulsa Law School, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you talk about the 14th Amendment. It's really interesting. You said when the 13th Amendment, which outlawed slavery, and the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed black men the right to vote, passed, there were parades, there was great celebrations. When the 14th Amendment and its guaranteed due process, which is put into place that fundamentally reshaped the notion of citizenship rights, nobody said anything. Nobody really knew much about this 14th Amendment.
Well, a lot of people in Congress and outside were disappointed with the 14th Amendment because it did not give black men the right to vote. Radical Republicans and, of course, African Americans themselves were demanding political rights as well as the due process and other rights mentioned in the 14th Amendment. When the amendment passed Congress, a lot of congressmen got up and said, gee, you know, I'm really disappointed. I'm going to vote for this because it's the best we can do right now. But I'm disappointed we didn't go all the way and really create an equal political system. Now, they would do that in the 15th Amendment a couple of years later. But it's ironic. The 14th Amendment has had a far greater impact on American life, on the expansion of democracy, the expansion of liberty, than any other part of the Constitution since its ratification, and yet when it was passed, it did not generate the enthusiasm, the celebration, the public parades that the 13th and 15th did. So people didn't quite anticipate how radically the 14th Amendment would change our whole legal and constitutional system.
Well, as you write in the book, this amendment came about in a whole spate of lawmaking designed to remake the South during Reconstruction. So I assume this is sort of a sausage-making amendment in a way?
Well, it's got five clauses. It's the sections. It's the longest amendment ever added to the Constitution. Basically, they're trying to put into the Constitution the North's understanding of what had been achieved in the Civil War. Some of the clauses have no bearing today, like it says Southern slave owners cannot get monetary compensation for the loss of their property and slaves. You know, today people talk about reparations. Back then, there were Southerners demanding that the owners get reparations, because after all, slaves were property. That property was abrogated. The 14th Amendment said, I'm sorry, no compensation. And by the way, if anyone bought Confederate bonds, you know, loaned money to the Confederacy out of patriotism in the South, they're not going to get that money back either. So that is irrelevant today, you know, but it was an important issue in 1866. But the key is the first section. But so as I say, it's dealing with all these questions, the results of the war. There's a convoluted section about black male suffrage that they're not willing to go to that yet, but they say, well, if any state denies black men the right to vote, they're going to lose some of their members of Congress. That was never enforced, but it was an attempt to encourage states to enfranchise the newly freed black population. And then, of course, the first section we've mentioned, equal protection, due process, birthright citizenship. So there's a lot in the 14th Amendment, maybe too much, because, as I say, it was a compromise between the more radical Republicans who wanted to go all the way to interracial democracy and others who felt that maybe it would be difficult to get such an amendment ratified. So, yeah, when it was passed, there was not as much enthusiasm as for the other amendments.
Well, of course, you know, the language of that first section, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the citizen of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protections of the law. This is really broad language. Did any of its proponents or opponents understand the impact of that broad language?
Well, opponents, you might almost say, understood it and also exaggerated. They said this means the states have no more power. This is the end of the federal system. The national government is now going to be all powerful. That wasn't the idea of the 14th Amendment. The idea of the 14th Amendment was to ask the states to act in a civilized, egalitarian manner, to treat all Americans as equal. And if they did, the federal government would not have any reason to intervene. But they had just experienced, you know, right after the Civil War, Andrew Johnson, who became president when Lincoln was assassinated, set up these all-white governments in the South, which proceeded to pass very discriminatory laws, the so-called Black Codes, against the former slaves. And Congress was alarmed, and they said, hey, wait a minute, they don't accept, in the South, they're not accepting the fact that slavery is over. So the 14th Amendment, all these amendments are meant to make sure that the states act henceforth in a, you know, in an egalitarian manner. If they do, no problem. Then there's no enforcement mechanism necessary. But if they don't, then the federal government can intervene. Well, as I said, this took away from the states a lot of power they had had beforehand. Up to the Civil War, as we said before, it was the states that had the power to define who was a citizen and what rights citizens had. Suddenly, they're losing that power. And so the people who opposed the 14th Amendment, including most of the white South, you know, this is the end of democracy, the end of federalism in the United States. And, it was the people who proposed it who said, no, it's not that extreme. Don't get so excited. You know, we're just trying to create basic equality for all American citizens.
When we hear that the Civil War wasn't about slavery, we should always remember these three amendments and the fact that these were designed to remind the South this war was about slavery, and this is how we expect states to act.
Yeah, I mean, this is sometimes debated today. At the time, everybody, you know, in his second inaugural address, March 1865, Lincoln said, I'm paraphrasing here, you know, look, folks, everybody knows that slavery was the cause of the war. All know, he said, that this was the cause. Everybody did know that in 1865. Not everybody knows it today, it seems.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the 15th Amendment. It's only two sentences. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Those two sentences, you write, marks a radical change in the political system. Voting rights had always been a state issue. That changed utterly with that amendment.
Right. The amendment, again, is meant to make sure that black men can vote everywhere in the country, which they had not in any significant numbers before the Civil War. But traditionally, the states controlled voting requirements. And, you know, even today, there is no national voting requirement in the United States. The requirements differ from state to state to state. What we do have now is a number of things that states cannot do. Because of the 15th Amendment, they can't deny you the right to vote because you're black. The 19th Amendment, 50 years later, you cannot deny someone the right to vote because they're a woman. And then more recently, 18 years old. But other than that, states can have all sorts of, and do have all sorts of different regulations. And so the 15th Amendment was again a compromise. There were those who wanted a positive statement. And unfortunately, nobody was promoting within Congress except for a handful of people women's suffrage. So the radicals wanted all male citizens 21 years older can vote. That would have solved a lot of problems in the future, but that's not what was passed. What was passed is you can't deny someone the right to vote because of race, but that left open all sorts of other mechanisms, such as literacy tests, poll taxes, understanding clauses, which later the southern states and Oklahoma, unfortunately, utilized to deny black men the right to vote without mentioning race. In other words, if they had passed laws saying, hey, black men can no longer vote, that would have clearly violated the 15th Amendment. But these other ones were implemented in a way that basically eliminated the black vote, even though they didn't specifically mention race. And the Supreme Court upheld that late in the 19th and early 20th century. They said, look, as long as they're not mentioning race, that's fine under the 15th Amendment. Yes, all the black people can no longer vote, but there's nothing we can do about that. It's basically what the Supreme Court said.
And of course, poll tax affected poor whites.
Poll taxes affected poor whites. The most common way of eliminating black voters was what they called the understanding clauses. That is to say that to register to vote, you have to demonstrate an understanding of the state constitution. And so that put it in the hands of local registrars. A black guy will turn up to register, and the guy, you know, the registrar, well, what is, you know, Section 22, Clause B of the state constitution? And the black guy, well, I'm not really sure. Well, you can't register. Whereas a white guy turns up, and they'll say, you know, what is the position occupied by the governor? And they say, well, he's the governor. Oh, all right, fine. You understand the state constitution, so you can vote. So it's the way these laws are implemented. You're right. The poll tax did eliminate quite a few poor whites, as well as many, many poor blacks. But the upper crust in these southern states didn't mind that. They were a little nervous about poor whites as well as blacks voting.
Well, after these three amendments are put into place, now the courts have to tell us what they actually mean. And the amendments were practically defined in the court system. And throughout the 1880s, you see a narrowing of the decision, the Slaughterhouse decision that you write about in the book. This has almost rendered a lot of the language of these amendments to be moot.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, there's a lesson in this history, which is the Constitution is not self-enforcing. Somebody has to enforce your rights, even when they're written into the Constitution. And Congress expected it was Congress that would do that. You know, these the amendments say Congress shall have the power. It didn't say the courts will do it, but the Supreme Court picked up the, you know, ability to basically nullify. About over the next generation, the Supreme Court virtually nullified the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, or to maybe put it more precisely, they allowed the southern states to nullify those amendments once Reconstruction was over, giving them a green light and overturning laws that Congress passed to try to enforce those rights. The Civil Rights Law of 1875 declared unconstitutional. The Enforcement Acts of the early 1870s, where they tried to protect the right to vote of black men in the South against violent, you know, mobs, the Ku Klux Klan, etc. The court significantly limited that. They upheld state laws requiring racial segregation, things like that. So, and of course, as I said before, when the Southern states did basically nullify the 15th Amendment, the Supreme Court threw up its hands and said, we can't do anything about that. So, yeah, unfortunately, it shows you what happens to people's rights when the Supreme Court is a conservative body which is not interested in protecting individual rights. Ironically, the court mostly used the 14th Amendment to protect the rights of corporations. They said, and we hear this today, corporations are legally persons. The 14th Amendment says no person can be denied due process. Therefore, states cannot regulate these corporations. They can't pass laws saying, regulating safety or regulating the hours of work or minimum wages or things like that. That all violates the due process rights of these persons. The corporations are persons. So, you know, down to today with the Citizens United decision, now corporations have the right to free speech and many other things which normally are only applied to real, actual human beings. So, you know, you had a very conservative court with little interest in the rights of black people, but a lot of interest in protecting the powers of corporations.
And of course, those decisions led to racial codes, Jim Crow.
It upheld the whole Jim Crow system, which was put in place in the 1890s and early 20th century, convict leasing, all sorts of oppressive measures, denying the right to vote, segregation. All this happened with the acquiescence of the Supreme Court. It's a very sad piece of the history of jurisprudence in our country.
I want to ask you one decision, the Slaughterhouse decision, which even recently the Supreme Court said, we're not going to touch this decision. And what it did was basically enumerated the fact that the state still had rights in a lot of situations, and that still stands as a precedent.
Oh, absolutely. Most of these, Plessy v. Ferguson, which upheld, racial segregation, was overturned by the Brown v. Board of Education decision, at least regarding education. But most of these other decisions are still on the books. They're still good law. And, one of my arguments is in a legal system in which precedent is so important, decisions which I think are based on a real misunderstanding of what Reconstruction was trying to accomplish are still shaping jurisprudence even to this very day. Slaughterhouse, it's a complicated case. I don't want to go into all the details, but basically it said, look, yes, the 14th Amendment said the state cannot deny the privileges or immunities of American citizens, but actually those don't amount to anything. It basically took that clause and said it really has no meaning. Almost all of your privileges of citizenship come from the states, not the federal government. So the federal government can't just, interfere with the states to impose their own will. So, it gave the states tremendous leeway in defining the rights of citizens or not recognizing them, unfortunately.
Mm. The name of the book is The Second Founding. We're still talking about these issues 150 years later. Eric Foner, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure talking to you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and professor emeritus of history at Columbia University, Eric Foner, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His most recent book, The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution, is published by Norton and will be the focus when he gives the Hager Distinguished Lecture in Law Thursday evening, October 17th at the TU Law School. The event is free to the public and gets underway with a reception at 5:30 with the lecture to follow. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.